From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for April Fool's Day 2022. The Bucks have a couple of home games this week as they get ready for the playoffs. The Brewers are a week away from the regular season opener. Two UK companies that produce bachelorette parties are in danger of going out of business. It's kind of a supply chain issue. The companies claim there's a national shortage of naked men. So now they've lowered their hiring standards so much that you don't have to be a bodybuilder or a cop or even a cowboy to get the gig. In our ever-expanding vocabulary, we now need to learn sober curious, also known as a non-drinker. There's a fad sweeping across America, bars that look like every other bar except they're totally alcohol-free. They need to put up some kind of warning sign or something, though. I'd hate to accidentally walk into one of those. Texan Robert Brockman faces the largest tax fraud case in American history. The government put a lien on his retirement pay and his house against his $1.5 billion tax bill. His defense is, it's not fair. What is he, seven? A completely paralyzed man who was left unable to communicate for months after losing the ability to even move his eyes received a brain implant to communicate better with his caregivers. And his first words were, I want a beer. He might be from Australia, but I think he's got a little Milwaukee in him, so let's keep him away from those sober, curious places. And finally, our goofy headline of the week, shooting reported at Shooter's Restaurant. Well, that's just a little too on the nose. Around the table today, we have Steve Giles, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and looking back at the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Jason. A bit surprised that that brain implant didn't lead to a few itches getting scratched that hadn't been scratched for a while, but I could certainly understand the desire for a beer some weeks. You know, this week overall, not terrible for stocks. The NASDAQ actually up 0.7%, closing today at the bell at 14,262. The S&P added 3 points, up 0.1%, closing at 45,46. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average down just 43 points this week, but up 140 points today, closing at the bell at 34,818. That's down 0.1% for the week. For the year, the Dow now down just 3.7%, the S&P down 4.3%, the NASDAQ still down a pretty meaningful 8.7%. You know, Steve, as we put a finishing touch on the first quarter here of what has been a pretty rough start to the year, March not so bad despite the fact that, you know, as we look at kind of the full year first quarter numbers for the S&P, you know, down 4.6%. You look, you know, more broadly, some challenges, I think, in growth stocks in particular. But surprised by how well some of the value stuff held up. Clearly, energy, you know, up significantly is a big piece of that. But, you know, what kinds of things are you talking to clients about right now as we kind of digest what was, if nothing else, an interesting first quarter?
Yeah, you know, Kyle, I think this last quarter was a fantastic reminder as to why we want to build diversified portfolios. And as much as this first quarter was down, looking back at historical performance for a number of my reviews, being reminded that during the financial crash of 2007, 2008, 2009, those three-month worst period numbers were by far much worse than anything we experienced just in the last 3 months. And it's a good reminder for investors who were able to sit on their hands back then, why would it be any different now? The market's only down, as you indicate, 4.3% on the S&P. We saw a pretty big pullback in 2007, 2008 during the financial crisis. And if you got through that time period, why wouldn't you be able to get through this period now? However, if you are now 15 years closer to retirement, if you're feeling a little bit more nervous in what's happening over the last few months with this recent uptick in the last week or so, maybe now is a good time to revisit what we call that stomach acid test and perhaps rebalance to an allocation that is more appropriate given what could be a change in your circumstances.
Chris, I think we look at March's returns for stocks is maybe an opportunity, right, to get a little bit better price than what you were expecting before, maybe capture some better prices on the stock piece of your portfolio if, you know, to Steve's point, the answers to that test is, yeah, maybe I need a little less risk here. Maybe I want to be a little more comfortable. I want to sleep a little better at night by dialing back. So, you know, what are you looking for when you talk to clients? What kinds of things have you been talking about the end of this first quarter here?
Well, to Steve's point, you know, this last few weeks has given you an opportunity to say, how did I feel when I saw the market pull back 10 plus percent? You know, was I sleeping fine at night? Did I know I could wait this through? Or was I getting pretty legitimately concerned, you know? And if you were legitimately concerned, I think that tells you a little bit, you know, something about yourself and your ability to withstand those swings. And now that the market has regained a fair amount of the footing in the last 2 weeks, it's given you this opportunity to say with a, you know, kind of clear head, all right, you know, I didn't feel too great during that correction. I could now, if I felt that, you know, I can't withstand these type of swings as well as I thought I could, I have an opportunity right now without really taking it on the chin too much to dial back risk a little bit and know that, hey, I've moved myself into a position maybe I should have been in all along.
Well, and also to that point, it's very, very important to remember that any money you think you might need in the next 6 to 18 months really shouldn't be in the market. Mm-hmm. I spoke to a lot of individuals in the last year or two with the markets going up that were inclined to take their emergency cash reserves, money they had in the bank, stuff that was in the mattress, wanting to chase those returns in the market and having to remind them that we don't know what's going to happen next week or next month. And if you had been earmarking that for a car purchase, if you had been earmarking that for, a home remodel project, and if you had put that money to work in December when the market was up after a fantastic 2021, you don't have as much as you did then. So this whole idea of making sure that you've got money set aside in buckets to address all of those expenses that you need, long-term bucket for your long-term retirement needs, money that you know you don't need for years and years and years. Have obviously your bond bucket, Chris, to account for some downside protection, some risk reduction, and the certainty of knowing that they're certainly much less volatile than stocks in general. But gosh, if you need money in the short term for big ticket items, have it in cash, have it in the bank. Yes, it's frustrating to put up with 0% interest with what the bank is paying you, but at least you're not losing principal.
Well, and I think, you know, it's almost contrary often to the way we feel about the markets, right? That when we're feeling great because the returns have been good, you want to put that cash to work. And so, you know, I certainly don't fault investors who look at strong returns and go, I want a piece of that. But I think, you know, you both rightfully point out, it isn't just about what you want. It's also about what you can afford to stomach and what you really should be stomaching based on your time horizon for the money. And so, you know, I think to that point, cash is going to be king for, you know, one very important reason, and that is that you always know it's going to be there for you. You know, the one catch right now, Steve, you mentioned cash isn't paying anything. We've seen interest rates creep up pretty significantly. We've seen the 30-year mortgage rate north of 4.5% this week now, the first time since 2018 we've crossed that threshold. And so I think, you know, we're starting to see some interest be paid on what are the real high-quality pieces, the money markets, the savings accounts. It's still nothing compared to what I think many of our clients are used to, many investors are used to, going back to the 80s, the 90s, even the early 2000s, when you could at least get something. But of course, you know, the drawback to that is that we've seen bonds sell off pretty substantially this year. And that's the part that, you know, I think so many investors had counted on being the piece that just wasn't going to go anywhere. Well, the reality is it can bounce around, but remember that bouncing around for stocks looks very different than bouncing around for bonds. And Chris, you know, I think there's another advantage to interest rates rising that we often don't point out to clients, and that is, you know, the benefits of what it means as we look ahead. You know, what kinds of things should investors expect from their bonds now that rates are a little bit higher?
Well, the simple way of putting this is the best estimate for what your return for your bond portfolio will be over a longer period of time is the current interest rate in which, you know, you're investing in, what the current yield on many of those bond portfolios are. You know, it'll move a little bit here and there based on what interest rates move, you know, whether you lose a little bit in the short term if rates go higher, or if you gain a little bit more than you anticipate in the short term because rates have went lower. But that's the best estimate. You know, to Steve's point before, you know, when banks were paying you nothing And interest rates on high quality bond funds were, 1% or one and some change. It was darn difficult to sit there and say, well, my only other option other than buying stocks is to put some money in bonds, and I'm barely going to make anything on that, and my bank doesn't pay me anything. It's kind of pushed people into the equity market, over the last few years, because there's just been so few opportunities. We sit here today after, bonds have taken on the chin a little bit because interest rates have gone up. But I sit here today saying, well, I look at the market and say, well, I can actually get paid something on some of this safe money in my portfolio. It makes it a little bit easier to build a good portfolio that has some safe money set inside it and know that I'm going to get paid for that money that I've set aside.
The other thing we've seen as interest rates have been rising, in particular the 10-year Treasury, is this inversion of the yield curve. And it's been talked about quite a bit this week in the financial press. It's been pointed out that it's something that was coming, I think. But, this week, really, we've seen an inversion happen a couple of times. It hasn't really held just yet, but, we're on the verge of it. And so, I think important for investors to first and foremost understand what an inversion is. And most often when bond investors are looking at the yield curve, what they're looking at is the rate they can get on bonds that mature near term, very soon, so looking at, over the next year or 2 years, versus what investors can get on bonds paying out much further into the future. And when we're looking at an inversion, what we're really looking at is the rate you can get on the 10-year Treasury versus the rate you can get on the 2-year Treasury. When the rate on that 2-year Treasury is higher than the 10-year Treasury, meaning you're getting paid more to buy a short-term bond than you are a long-term bond, you essentially have entered an inverted yield curve. And for a variety of reasons, that can be a scary thing for investors. It tends to signal recession. Every recession since 1950 has been preceded by an inversion of the yield curve. But it isn't as simple as saying, well, we've inverted, and so now that recession is coming. Chris, I think, it's something you look at quite a bit. It's something we talked about this week in our Monday morning meeting. But, how should investors really be thinking about this? What's a pretty technical term, a pretty technical indicator, but I think, speaks to some of our broader expectations for the economy going forward.
Yeah, there's a few points I'd like to first bring up. The first being is, historically, yes, it's been a good indicator of a recession, but it's not a really great short-term indicator. Typically when the yield curve does invert, which, we're close to doing, or depending on how you want to judge it, some would say it has, it's usually somewhere in the range of 6 to 24 months. That's a pretty long time period. And there's been times when it's inverted and it's gone 3 or 4 years before there was actually a recession. So whether you want to say that's a great indicator, if it called it 4 years early, we can, go back and forth. But the other important thing I'd point out is, typically when the yield curve inverts, it's because on the long end of the curve, rates aren't very high. And that's the market essentially saying, we don't expect growth to remain very strong in the economy. So it's a market, in a way, predicting that a recession would come. So that's one thing to kind of understand when you look at the yield, what it's telling you. Now, the final point that I'll add is, there's been a few people that have been out there arguing that, the reason why long rates are so low is because the Fed is buying securities in that long end of the curve, and they're intentionally keeping the long end of the curve down. So do we really have a free-flowing interest rate curve that is telling you all the information you think it should, or is it kind of being manipulated by the Federal Reserve by buying long-term rates? And we could go back and forth on that, and that's kind of a high-level inside baseball. But the main thing investors should know is, it's typically been a pretty good predictor. It doesn't mean anything's going to happen near term. And it just essentially is the market saying, we think growth is going to slow down going forward.
And of course, I think the market is also saying right now that they have every expectation that the Fed's going to do what it takes to slow inflation. And mm-hmm. So, I think we've seen comments over the last couple of weeks from Fed members, voting Fed members in particular, saying, hey, maybe that, quarter point increase could have been a half a point increase, and maybe the next few can be half a point increases. Joel, I think as the economic data still shows, the economy may be strong enough to support some of that, in particular the labor data this week pointing to continued strength.
Kyle, we got the numbers today on March employment, and a lot of the indicators are looking like it's back to February of 2020 before the pandemic had hit us. Now, getting back to February of 2020 is nice. The the world has changed. We, you know, our country has grown, actually. We've added population. We're adding about 1 million people a year. So getting back to that's just kind of a nice thing. But yeah, a lot of the numbers, the unemployment rate is 3.6%. It was 3.5% back in February of 2020, and that's the lowest it's been in 50 years. The number of people, the number of jobs that are out there, it's within a 1.6 million now. I mean, remember we lost 22 million. We're within 1.6 million of where we were back then. We've had 11 months in a row now that we've had 400,000 jobs or more added per month, and that's the biggest, greatest streak we've had in the time that they've measured these things going back to 1939. We had also numbers this week on the job openings, and that's another indicator showing that we've got two job openings right now for everybody looking for a job. Usually, over time, the time that they've been measuring this, it's usually two job seekers for every job opening. So that's been, you know, flipped around. And the thing is, this is all changing yet. People are still coming into the workplace. They're still deciding to go back to work, to get a job, to get a different job. We, you know, the job openings data showed us that the quit rate is still, you know, we've got 4.3 million jobs a month now that workers are saying, you know, I think I could do something better somewhere else.
And wages are great as well. I mean, granted, if the economy was only wages and employment, things would look, you know, absolutely perfect. Of course, you've got that inflation thing that's hanging out there that makes it not quite as awesome, unfortunately, but wages have been strong as well.
Yes, the data today showed that the average wage went up 5.6% from a year ago. That's pretty good. But, you know, we had other numbers this week showing that inflation is at a 40-year high of 6.4%, depending upon which number you look at. So that's a problem. And we also had numbers from the Conference Board on their consumer confidence. And the surveys showed that consumers are expecting inflation to be at the highest level they've ever expected it to be at in the history of these surveys. So that's sort of tamping down their optimism for the future. They're feeling good about how they are doing today, but they're kind of having doubts about whether they're going to be spending tomorrow, and we know that spending's such a big part of our economy.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out, too, on that inflation front, the reason why most consumers probably aren't as worried about inflation longer term is because, one, the Fed is going to be addressing this. Two, the 10-year hasn't jumped or spiked the way that you would think it would if inflation were really a big concern for the street.
I think the other big thing that reflected some inflationary pressures this week was the ISM Purchasing Managers Index number. Pretty clear that manufacturing, while still growing, has slowed a bit recently.
It slowed to its lowest level since September of 2020. So that's a time back, and it's still when we were more concerned about the economy and where it was going. But it's been expanding. The manufacturing sector has been expanding every month for the last 22 months. So that's a good sign right there. There was also some indication, and this is a survey-based index, that some people in the survey said that there are signs that some of the pressures on inflation, some of the supply chain snags, that those are starting to ease. So that's good news, too.
And buried in that data was some signs that there may be some backlogs as well in demand, right? And so I think if you're concerned about recessionary pressures, as the yield curve inversion we talked about earlier maybe indicates, you know, there's plenty of pent-up demand in the system right now that should keep economic growth, the engines of economic growth, running for a while longer here. And so I think, you know, the very solutions that we're coming up with for these inflationary problems are the things that could prolong this expansion a little while longer than I think some people believe right now. You know, I think the other big data point this week was construction spending. I saw an article a couple of different places this week, but talking about the Brewers' new designated hitter being unable to find a house in the Milwaukee area. And I think, you know, construction spending has kind of spoken to the one way we might be able to bolster supply a little bit.
I think we mentioned a couple of weeks ago that the houses under construction right now is at the highest level since 1973. That's a long time. So we saw numbers this week on construction spending. Most of it is driven, half of it is driven by residential construction spending, and it's at another record high. It's slowed down a little bit from recent months, but there too, we also had numbers on the consumer housing prices from the Case-Shiller National Index, and that's showing 20% inflation rate for the prices of houses year to year. And there's some belief, though, again, that this supply demand balance is always shifting, and there's belief now that as mortgage rates go up, the highest it's been since 2018, that those are going to start crimping demand a little. So as that supply comes on, the demand is also going to be going down.
Yeah, it just seems like that inflation word is the one piece that seems to be hanging out there across all this economic data. I think as we transition into earnings season here in the next couple of weeks for the end of the first quarter, you're going to hear that word quite a bit more. We're going to get a lot more information about, I think, what many of the corporate leaders in America think the real impact of inflation will be to their bottom line. And that's the piece for me that's going to be most critical to kind of how we navigate market returns over the next few months, because I think what they have to say about inflation and how long they think it's going to stick around will really make its way into pricing. It'll really make its way into kind of our expectations for stocks. So, I'm encouraged, continue to be encouraged by what has been pretty strong economic data for a while now. And again, I think the earnings piece will be the piece to watch now, just to see how it follows that economic data. Beyond some of the stuff this week, I think we've got a newsletter coming out this afternoon, number of contributions from colleagues around the office here. What stands out to you, Joel?
Well, actually, you wrote a piece looking at this whole, what the Fed is doing and the difficult task that they have before them in trying to figure out how to address inflation and what investors should know about that. I wrote an article about the phenomenon of unretirement, which actually Steve and Chris and you talked about a couple of weeks ago on this podcast. But that's an interesting phenomenon and something that we're seeing is happening more beyond Tom Brady. So the bottom line of it is it's just another thing that people should be talking with their advisors about. It's another talking point in conversations about, how you're setting your money aside and what you're going to be doing with it.
And timely given the employment report this week and timely given the conversations we just had a few minutes ago, looking at, the number of job openings per people searching for a job. Well, if you can add to the people searching for a job, you may be able to slow that number down a little bit and fill some of those vacancies. And so I think this, it's critical kind of how all these pieces work together for us to really understand what the outlook is, remain cautiously optimistic, remain kind of encouraged by the path we see. But again, I think, there's a lot that needs to be done still by the Fed, and they've been clear that they're willing to do what it takes. So we're going to keep our eyes on that in the months to come. I think we're going to keep our eye on this earnings season as it kicks off here in a couple of weeks. And beyond that, thanks for listening. We always enjoy doing the program, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.